As you listen to this Dharma talk, you might consider doing so, staying close to your six senses, where sense contact is made, to allow yourself to listen, hear, register, receive, but without searching in your mind to understand. Without working your mind to remember or to think about what's being said or apply it or debate it. Maybe without the work of liking or not liking, or preferring and not preferring. As you listen to this talk, maybe just listen and see, just allow what happens to happen. So yesterday the topic was seeing things as they are from the perspective of sense contact, to see that at the basic level of how we perceive our world through sense contact, things are perceived as inconstant, without self, and as suffering if we cling to them. When I was in Thailand, in Burma, practicing there, there was, I suspect that the most common, by far, theme for Dharma talks was the three characteristics, these three. Over and over again, I heard these talks. It pointed out to how important it is in this tradition, this insight. But these talks seemed so dogmatic to me because they were making claims that to see these things, or sometimes not even just if you see them, but just this is the truth, that this describes the fundamental truths of reality. So it was kind of like a Buddhist physics, that the nature of reality, of nature, of everything, is this way. And I don't know, maybe it's true. And then young idealistic people, like when I was such a person, and other people back then who was like this, kind of like was very much attracted to these ultimate truths and felt like really important to be connected to what was ultimately true. And then we would do these practices of Vipassana and start experiencing things arising and passing. There's no self here. The dukkha quality of experience, of perception. And lo and behold, we were experiencing what we were told was the ultimate nature of reality. And so we believed that we had understood. Now we saw for ourselves something that was ultimately true about reality everywhere you go in the cosmos, only because we closed our eyes and paid attention to what was going on in the moment-to-moment experiences of the senses. We generalized to reality as a whole. And I learned over time that this wasn't necessary. though it was very reassuring to think we knew ultimate truths. And other people don't have ultimate truths, so you know, we are in the good camp. But in the teachings of the Buddha, that's not the purpose of these three characteristics. They aren't actually presented as the physics of reality. These are ultimate truths of everything. In the Buddha's teachings, they're called perceptions. The understanding what we perceive, or something about perception itself. So they aren't something but reality as a whole. Now this can be quite disappointing because it's reassuring, as I said, to know ultimate truths. But we can know ultimate truths through this practice. Not only we can know them, but we can know them with great conviction. We can really know for ourselves this is true. We can know without doubt that if we cling, we will suffer. We will know that if we let go of that clinging, that suffering will go away. We will know that it's possible to do a lot of house cleaning and really empty out a lot of the craving, clinging, obsessions, compulsions, preoccupations that in some sense hold the mind captive. We'll know that it's amazing what you can learn about yourself if you sit quietly and watch. You can really see how the mind operates. And you can see places of choice, karmic choice, dharmic choice, places where we can choose whether to get a second helping of food, even though we know we're already full. And we know that we won't be comfortable in an hour if we do, but it's so tasty. And we know that there's a choice. So these kinds of things we'll know. And what makes them ultimate is when we realize we get a glimpse of that. How pervasively useful these insights, understandings are in our life. What would you rather have? Have some piece of knowledge about the nature of the universe, nature of, you know, something like consciousness or anything ultimate. Would you like to have that knowledge and have all your suffering as well? Or would you prefer to have none of your suffering and not have that ultimate piece of information about the cosmos? Some of you say, well, can't I have both? So this Buddhist tradition has a very specific interest. It's really clear the Buddha was not interested in grand theories of the universe of reality. He was interested in something very human. He was interested in the operation of the mind, the heart, and how to do each of us for ourselves and maybe for others. A huge favor, huge gift. Maybe the greatest gift anyone can give anyone. And that is the peace and the happiness of no longer suffering. bringing suffering to an end. And so these three characteristics are not meant to be truths to hold on to, but rather as means to the possibility of letting go of clinging, of attachments, and some of the deepest ones we can have. So how does these three characteristics function as a means for bringing suffering to an end? So I'll get back to this topic. The basic practice we're doing here is just to be mindful of what is, mindful of what's here now, and perhaps to see if that mindfulness itself can be non-reactive, that it can be simple, it can be softly still, quiet, just knowing what's here. And the real art of this mindfulness is to be content, really content, with being mindful of what you're given any given moment. And it doesn't really matter a lot. Relatively, it doesn't matter so much what you're attending to with mindfulness. We tend to get focused a lot on the object of what we know, our experience. For this mindfulness practice, what's important is the mindfulness itself, the knowing itself. But knowing has to know something. But don't be too concerned about the something. Just enough to know it well and let it. But it's the clarity of mindfulness, the continuity of mindfulness, that is really where the beginning of loosening up the attachment begins to happen. And what this means is that as we go through the ups and downs of a retreat, it doesn't matter whether one sitting you're as peaceful as you've ever been in your life, and the next sitting you're so agitated that you don't even know what mindfulness is anymore. It just matters that given whatever you're given, whatever is up, that you maintain a simple, relaxed continuity, knowing this, being with this, recognizing this, experiencing this, and not getting agitated, not getting into stories, interpretations about what it means and what's happening and who you are. Just okay. This is my turn to be present for agitation. Now is his turn to be present for peace. I don't know why it's one now and the other one later. But as I like to say, trust that if your practice is sincere, the Dharma knows what's best for you. Much better than you could ever guess. So as we sit, if at those times when we can sit very quietly, very peacefully, very still, and there's not a lot of activity or working of the mind, spinning of the mind, And for example, we can just be really close to the sense doors, experiencing the senses as we go along, the sense contact. Some fascinating things can be seen. One is, how subtle is the working of the mind? In a way you can't even imagine in ordinary life. In ordinary life, if you need to go shopping for plumbing pieces for your sink, and you kind of know where the hardware store is, but you've never really, you're not familiar with it. You hardly know what these plumbing pieces are. And so you're going down the aisles of the hardware store and looking, and your eyes are darting this way and that. Is this where the pipe pieces are? Is this where the pipe pieces are? I think it's down there. You see the sign, plumbing pieces, and say, oh, okay, good. So you head on that way, looking down the aisle. And is it on the right or left of this aisle, the pieces I want? And the mind's looking and searching and hardly notice that it's so automatic to search this way, to look. On a retreat like this, at those times when the mind is very, very quiet and still, and the mind is hardly moving, you're sitting there at the sense doors, and you see if you can perceive if there's a sound, that the movement of the mind kind of to turn towards the sound to know what it is in fact the mind working. It takes a little bit of mental energy to turn the mind to what is that? And you can feel that movement. You can feel the engagement of the mind to know and to turn towards it. It's possible to be very, very still in meditation and open your eyes and have sight data come into your eyes. And just, you know, not really make anything of it. And then see that to recognize that the object in front of you is a meditation bell, it actually takes a little bit of work to recognize that or to name that, to organize the sight objects. That's all it's called, the data's coming in. Oh, that's a bell. Now, for some of you, this will sound ridiculous. I mean, it's so automatic, so effortless, seemingly, to do these sight objects, to see things so simply. But in the context of a mind that's very, very still, we can start seeing the tremendous subtlety of how perception, what's happening when we perceive and turn the attention towards something or interpret it or organize our mind to kind of take it all in. And we're not just innocent perceivers. The mind has a role. It works a teeny, teeny bit. And where there is work, if there's a potential for karma, the karmic stream. Looking for the plumbing pieces in the hardware store, it's karmic if I'm really strong attachment, even greed, to get this over quickly, to get out of there so I can get back to reading my novel, that I'm irritated over that the sink problem has gotten in the way of. And so in the very searching down the aisles for the pipe, it, it isn't just a neutral looking. Even they're ever so slight, there's an extra little contraction, tightness, reaching out that's propelled by that very subtle desire to get this over quickly. And we would never see this in ordinary life. It would just seem like we're not doing anything. We're just going down. The only thing we're doing is walking down the aisle and looking. But each individual act of perception. And so we start seeing a few things. We start seeing how subtle the workings of karma are, the workings of the way we infuse desires and wants and compulsions into even acts of perception. And we can see that there's a kind of suffering there. There is a kind of an ouch in this kind of tightening and contraction, in this very subtle participation and pushing into perception. Wow. So in deep meditation, when you're so still, it can seem like, I don't want to bother with that. Why should I? There's no need. There's a sound. There's no need to bring the attention to the sound. Just leave it alone. There's no need to direct the mind. Have a desire of what perception does with the mind. It's possible to get very quiet and still. And even though the reference point here is very still meditation, this is also true in core states of mind. You can sometimes feel the intensity of the wanting that goes into seeing and searching in life. Sometimes just looking at advertisements in a magazine or on the web now, searching for something to buy. The perception is not so innocent, it's engaged. So there can be a sense of well-being, a sense of peace, a simplicity, where it just feels like we're so content to not do the work, to not get involved in all these things. And then as we and so there starts to be a disenchantment with the karmic work, a disenchantment with doing the efforts that are infused with desire and aversion, fear. And it's an amazing thing to begin to see that there's some choice here not to add this, not to do it. So the disenchantment with that. When we start seeing the three characteristics, there's also a disenchantment about if things are really changing all the time and there's no self in it and the clinging brings suffering, there's a disenchantment with suffering, with clinging, with grasping, a disenchantment with anything to do with self. There's no reliable happiness to be found in identity. There's no reliable happiness to be found in getting things. There's no reliable happiness to be found in pushing things away. There is a reliable happiness to be found in putting down the clinging, the grasping. The reactivity. And so a disenchantment. And so seeing things as they are is the condition for the arising of disenchantment. And I don't know how perfect the English translation is for the Pali, but I love this word disenchantment. To no longer be enchanted, which means no longer be under the spell. That we can be under all the time, spell, what's going to make us happy or what's going to make us safe or all kinds of things. It's also a kind of feeling of enough already. Wow, I've been doing this clinging thing, this desire thing, this wanting and going and working of the mind for so long. Wow. You know, enough already. How many times do I have to think the same thing? How many times do I want more or less the same thing? How many times do I judge the same thing or do the same activities? They say that one characteristic of delusion is to do the same thing 10,000 times, always expecting to get a different result. If I just win this lottery ticket, then I'll be happy. And so enough already, enough. Give me a break. There's a very healthy form of wisdom that takes the form of enough already. So it dawns on the mind that the spell gets broken, the allure, the promise of what we thought attachments would do begins to be broken. And that's a condition for what's called in the tradition dispassion. And so disenchantment has to do with no longer believing the object, this thing we're trying to do, will make a difference. The thing we're trying to grasp. The dispassion is the process of loosening the grasp, relaxing the grip until there's no more grip. The fist is no longer clenched. And this is the function of seeing deeply the inconstancy of reality, the not self of experience, the suffering there is so that we begin a process of no longer believing in clinging, grasping, aversion, all these activities of the mind. And we begin loosening up on it, softening it. So in the liberative dependent arising, it goes from seeing things as they are to disenchantment to dispassion. In the ordinary dependent arising, once you get to the six sense doors, it goes to a different insight. It's related to the three characteristics, but it has a different angle. And that's something that's called nama rupa, name and appearance. When the mind is quiet enough, still enough, we see how the mind names things. And the name is not the same thing as the thing. the word sunset is not the same thing as a sunset. The name Gil is not the same thing as Gil. The word meditation is not the same thing as your meditation any given time, moment. And so there's a tendency, we have this mind that can make names of things. And they're very useful. Without them, how are we going to communicate with each other? And it's possible to also appreciate that we don't have to be wedded to them, that we don't have to only see reality through the lens of the names. And one of the reasons not to do that is that we get attached to names, to the concepts. And so once we have a name or a concept, then sometimes we're seeing through that concept. If we see the sunset through our concept of what sunsets are supposed to be, we might look at a sunset and say, well, that's an inappropriate sunset. I think that's the wrong kind of sunset because it's not, doesn't match my idea of it. You know, we need to do something about the sunsets. And so to begin loosening, seeing that how much we name things is part of what Vipassana practice is beginning to do. But the other thing is that the other half of it is we name what appears. Things arise, things appear. Sensations appear, thoughts appear. Feelings appear. And we have a name for it, a concept for it. And in traditional Vipassana practice, when the mind gets quiet enough, there's a clear understanding that these are two different things happening. There's the appearance of sensations, of experience, and there's the knowing of it. There's here called the name, the knowing of it, the naming of it, the label of it. And it can be innocent to do these two things. But when we see them as being two distinct things, then they're not entangled with each other. So if I have an idea of what sunsets are supposed to be like, or say it maybe this is another example, I sometimes have an idea of where the apples are in my refrigerator. Maybe we have one apple. I know we have an apple there. So apple, refrigerator. And it's always supposed to be on a particular shelf. And so apple, the second shelf, refrigerator, is kind of like all a singular thing. And I can't really see them apart. I'm entangled with the name, the idea, the concept of how things should be. And I just can't, I look all over. I can't see the apple. I asked my wife, you know, do we have apples? Yeah, it's right in the refrigerator. Where? It turns out it's smack in the middle in the front in front of me. This has happened to me. It just wasn't where my mind had constructed the idea where it's supposed to be. So it was invisible to me because I was looking behind on the second shelf here and there. So I know this is a good example, but the example is that of if we don't like something, and the knowing of it is mixed up with not liking, then of course the thing is not a good thing, because we see it, the appearance of it and the undesirability of it is seen together. So all the ways we're for and against things, we kind of infuse it into the object. And it's terrible when we do that for people. Somehow, whatever reason, we don't like someone, and the our very way we perceive that person is kind of the same. It's all mixed together. Of course the person's a bad person, because I see it. Because the seeing is mixed with. But when we can see that there's a name, a concept that arises, distinct from what that we appear, there's a gap between them. There's a possibility of a lot of wisdom. It's a possibility of generosity and letting people or friends be who they are. And so the seeing, the nama rupa, the name and the appearance. But one of the reasons why this is important to Vipassana, it's another way of beginning to see how transient things are, inconstant, changing things are. Because when the concept and the object are entangled, we tend to think of it much more in constant terms. You know, that the word cat, kind of in English, since I've been speaking English, has kind of been unchanging reference for cats. There's nothing impermanent about the name word cat. It's like, you know, it seems like it's always, wherever words live, concepts live, it's always the same concept with that word. But our cat at home does not behave the same way all the time. The cat is constantly changing, but the concept cat might not change. So I don't know if this is a good example, but I'm hoping this is at least good enough to get the word, the idea across. So when concept and appearance get joined, things can seem more permanent. I see my friend through my concepts, and my friend doesn't seem to change. But if I see my friend distinct from my concepts, I see my friend is changing all the time. And so being able to, as the mind gets quieter and quieter, part of the function of mindfulness is to see that this naming of the mind and the appearance of things, the appearance and the name, are two different things. Doesn't have to be any work to see this. It just, as mind is clear enough, quiet enough, it's kind of obvious. And then it's easier to see that these things are all changing. Whereas the word cat as a concept might be permanent, my mind's, the appearance of that concept in my mind is not. The thought appears cat. It's there for a moment and then it goes away. The appearance of the cat is what it is for a moment, and the cat is changing. And I see the change. To sit quietly, peacefully, and to allow for this deeper experience of the changing nature of things, where things are allowed to be left alone. We don't paint our concepts on top of them. We don't see things through the filter of our ideas. But we don't necessarily stop our ideas, our concepts. We just see them as being distinct. We see them as a particular activity of the mind, of the moment. Oh, there's a concept, there's an idea. When the mind is quiet enough, you can see something appears, and then almost immediately there's the name, the concept, the appearance and the name. Sometimes it's said to be form and mentality. We see something and then the mind knows it. It's one of the other ways in which we start softening up the solid, the hegemony, the authority of solidity, that things are just what they are, as they always have been. It's a way of settling back and beginning to see and participate in the river of life, the changing stream of experience. And as we do so, the more we become disenchanted and dispassionate, the more peaceful we will become, more at ease we'll become, more settled. So these are a lot of words, a lot of explaining, and that's why I began the talk. Please don't try to understand too much. Watch your mind instead. Are you straining to understand? Are you turning your attention, your perception, to listen harder? Are you turning away because it's too many words? Are you stirred up by trying to understand this, or because you're excited about the novelty of this? Whatever it is, whatever this talk has done, that's the place to practice. The talk appeared, and you had concepts about it. And then you might have lived in those concepts, picked them up. Maybe they took over. Karmic concepts. But whatever it is, it's all good if you just practice mindfulness. This is what's happening now. This is how I am now. This is what's going on. Maybe it's better done a bit more thoroughly by going back into your meditation posture. Where things can settle down. Maybe it's simpler just to then perceive and sense and feel what's happening with you. And my hope in giving this talk is not so much that you understood what I said, though that would be nice, but rather it arose your interest in sitting quietly and seeing what's going on for you. An interest in the role of perception and how you perceive, even the simplest things, not as work or as a puzzle, but as a simple, simple openness to be curious. That you're a little more prone now to get quieter, so you can learn what can be discovered when your mind is quiet. So you're a little bit more inclined to be content with knowing what is, knowing what appears without getting entangled with it, even if what's arisen is agitation or distraction. That's what appears, and that can be known. The simple, simplest movement of knowing. What can be known when all things get quiet, still? Let what appears be what appears. Let the knowing be the knowing. By seeing them as being distinct, each can exist in their radical simplicity. And maybe you can find a place in between that's even more simple. A simplicity of being here and now. Thank you all.